passing.
Well, I want to add just one more thing in this 1 minute. Just like Azmet said, because there was no exit corridor for ISIS, they were forced to stay in the city and fight. And the excessive use of force, because some, probably one member of ISIS would be on top of a roof of a building. Just remember, Azmet, the guy we met from Al Layla family. There were two members, ISIS, on his roof, and the whole house was bombed. This was excessive use of force. My friends in Mosul told me of really precision bombing on small cars, and only the car will be hit. But when you...
We have 10 seconds.
Kill one person, yeah, to kill one person, you don't demolish your whole house. This is really terrible. I'm sorry for all the loss that has happened. I really would like the Americans to restudy their strategy.
We're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us, Bassem Raza from Erbil, Iraq, and Asmat Khan and Anand Gopal. We will link to their story, The Uncounted. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of What Now? Tuesday, November 21st at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. What Now is an event and movement created in the days after the November 2016 elections to channel collective frustration and fear into positive direct action in the community. This year's What Now event offers multiple engagement opportunities for Portlanders of all communities, backgrounds, and ages. Again, that's What Now, Tuesday, November 21st at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a judge rules against Trump and says the military has to pay for gender reassignment surgeries.
What's in a symbol? A lot if it's the white stag emblem cherished by both a brewery and the city of Portland.
In parts of Oregon, it can be a long drive to the nearest financial institution. Small credit unions are sensing opportunity. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 21st, 2017. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Annette Newell. A large Oregon brewery is defending a much smaller Portland brewery. The brouhaha has gotten so rough, the bigger brewery, Rogue Ales, is even banning Portland's mayor and his lawyers from its locations. The debate is about the white stag logo from the sign along the Burnside Bridge. Old Town's owner filed for and won a federal trademark of the White Stag logo for beer and alcohol. But the city of Portland applied for a similar trademark using the Stag logo and the Portland sign. Now Rogue Ales and Spirits has announced its support online, saying, quote, "We have no patience for those at City Hall who want to foolishly and unduly harass a fellow independent craft brewer." However, in a series of tweets, Michael Cox, a spokesman for Mayor Ted Wheeler, says the city is not contesting Old Town logo. He writes, "They have all the rights and privileges to use their logo as they see fit. This is about Portland's ability to use the iconic Portland sign to promote our city's brand."
The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has reached a settlement with Bullseye Glass Company. It includes a more than $15,000 fine and a requirement for immediate cleanup. In 2016, the department discovered stormwater runoff from the company's roof had been going into an underground dry well. It contaminated soil and groundwater with cadmium and selenium, which has settled on the factory's roof after the company released them into the air through unfiltered furnaces. The Department of Environmental Quality approved Bullseye's cleanup plan last month. It says Bullseye has removed the contaminated dry well and is installing wells to monitor groundwater quality.
The race for Portland City Council Position 3 was off to a crowded start this year after Dan Salzman announced he would not be seeking re-election. Last fall, several prospective candidates were rumored to be running. Those possible candidates were Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith, NAACP President Joanne Hardesty, Metro Councilor Sam Chase, Multnomah County Chief Operating Officer Marissa Madrigal, and Multnomah Commissioner and former lawmaker Jules Bailey, along with other whispers of yet more people interested in throwing their hats into this race. Most have withdrawn their claim to campaign. Last night, KBU spoke with Marissa Madrigal, who confirmed that she will not be running for city council after all. Jules Bailey accepted a new position as chief steward at the Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative after unsuccessfully running for Portland mayor. Sam Chase said in a statement to the Willamette Week that he wants to give room for people of color to step up. It's not the right time for me, about his decision to also step out of the race. Loretta Smith cannot seek re-election for her position due to term limits and also cannot announce her candidacy until January. So far, only three candidates have completed applications and fees in order to begin campaigning. Those candidates are Joanne Hardesty, mayoral staffer Andrea Valderrama, and Felicia Williams, president of the Downtown Neighborhood Association. The KBOO Evening News will be moderating a debate this spring and hosting specials for the current city council candidates this winter.
A judge has sentenced an Oregon woman to 2 years in prison after her inmate boyfriend died from her meth-laden kiss. The Associated Press reports that U.S. District Judge Marco Hernandez ordered Melissa Blair to complete 3 years of supervision, drug treatment, and mental health programs. Court records say Blair kissed her boyfriend, Anthony Powell, during a prison visit and passed balloons filled with meth from her mouth to his. Powell and two other inmates planned to get the drugs into the prison, but he died of meth poisoning after two of the balloons burst in his stomach. Powell was serving time for murdering his mother-in-law.
In eastern and southern Oregon, it can often be a several dozen mile drive to the nearest financial institution. So smaller credit unions are sensing an opportunity. For more, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has a story from Oregon News Service.
Last year, Senator Jeff Merkley reached out to the Northwest Credit Union Association, explaining that a rural part of Lake County in southern Oregon was in need of financial services. Today, Pacific Crest Federal Credit Union is holding the grand opening of its newest branch in Christmas Valley. Chad Olney is president and CEO of the Klamath-based credit union. He says Pacific Crest went to the area to hear some of the challenges community members were facing so that his institution could serve their needs.
You hear stories about people who may get a paycheck and need to deposit it, but it's 60 miles to the nearest financial institution to be able to deposit those funds and needing to scrape together the gas money to be able to get there to deposit the funds just so that they have them.
An Econ Northwest report notes that credit unions have become lifelines for rural Northwest communities as large for-profit institutions pull out of small communities. Credit unions serve more than 400,000 rural Oregonians and are present in 31 of the state's 36 counties. Olney says the Christmas Valley branch could become the blueprint for other rural branches. The new operation in North Lake County is small. There are two full-time employees and one part-time employee, and the branch will use video conferencing technology to contact loan officers in the Klamath Falls headquarters, 120 miles to the south. Olney says having personnel in the office for people in the area to speak to is important.
It's really hard to know and understand intimately the needs of the people in any given community without actually having people there to meet with them, to build those relationships, and to have those robust conversations that really help people to communicate what their needs are and for us to be able to meet those needs.
Credit unions are not-for-profit, member-owned cooperatives. About half of Oregonians are members of these institutions. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman. This is a story from the Oregon News Service written by Eric Tegedoff.
And now we hear about this day in labor history from Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day the completion of the Alaskan Highway, or ALCAN, was celebrated at Soldier Summit. There had been proposals for a highway connecting the United States to Alaska since the early 1920s. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Roosevelt moved quickly to organize its approval and construction. By March 1942, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers broke ground on the $138 million project. More than 10,000 troops were assigned to highway construction. Over a third were comprised of newly formed black regiments. Thousands of pieces of construction equipment were moved through the railroads, including steam shovels, blade graders, tractors, trucks, bulldozers, snowplows, cranes, and generators. In a matter of 8 months, workers carved out 1,700 miles of road between Dawson Creek, British Columbia, through the Yukon to Delta Junction in Alaska, under the most treacherous environmental conditions. Workers arrived in wintry Dawson Creek, pitching their sleeping quarters in snowdrifts. By spring, workers battled flooding rivers, equipment sinking into thick mud, and fears of Japanese bombers. By summer, mosquitoes, dubbed bush bombers, were so bad, workers had to eat under netting. Black workers also battled relentless racism. The army was still segregated. Black troops faced racial presumptions about their capacity to carry out hard labor. They were determined to break down stereotypes. By fall, white and black bulldozer drivers coordinating the work together were celebrated in the pages of the Army's Yank magazine, Time, and the New York Times. Some historians consider the integrated work crews a factor in President Truman's later move to desegregate the armed forces. According to the New York Times, the Federal Highway Administration calls the ALCAN the road to civil rights. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
In today's report from National Native News, members of the Treaty Alliance speak out against the Keystone XL pipeline, and authorities investigate a deadly shooting at a Northern California tribe. Here's the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Keystone XL pipeline project now has permission to cross Nebraska. Victoria Wicks has more on the decision, which was announced Monday by the state's Public Service Commission.
PSC Commissioner Crystal Rhodes says the pipeline route approved by the PSC is not the route that was vetted by state and federal agencies and subject to public hearings and comment. And so, she says, it violates due process.
There are at least 40 landowners along the approved route who may not even know that their land is in this pipeline's path. Since they may not know that they are in the path of the pipeline, they may not have participated in this proceeding.
The commissioner also says TransCanada's required consultation with Native people was done with an out-of-state tribe. She cites a report from the Department of State.
The applicant reported, according to the DOS, that they had worked with the Southern Ponca tribe who reside in Oklahoma.
Rhodes says the route runs over the Ogallala Aquifer and through several miles of fragile soils subject to landslides that will not be easily restored after construction. After the commission meeting, pipeline opponents rallied to declare their intention to continue fighting the pipeline. TransCanada issued a written statement saying the company will evaluate its costs versus benefits before deciding whether to build the line. I'm Victoria Wicks.
The Treaty Alliance, an organization which represents 150 U.S. and Canadian tribes, is speaking out against the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline. As Jim Kent reports, Treaty Alliance members say they're disappointed the pipeline would be approved days after an oil spill in South Dakota.
In approving the Keystone XL pipeline, the Nebraska Public Service Commission noted that it, quote, could not factor in spill considerations, end quote. Larry Wright Jr. is chairman of the Ponca tribe in Nebraska. He says it's sad, but the decision didn't surprise him.
And it really shows you what mentality is going on here, that even in light of that leak that is half a state away from Nebraska, on a scale that we don't even know yet, how can we possibly say yes to that? And yet they did. Time and again, example after example is given, and people choose to ignore those things.
Ponca tribal members are concerned over the impact the pipeline may have on traditional lands it will cross, as well as the Oglala Aquifer. Crow Creek Tribal Chairman Brandon Sazu was among those protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation last year. Sazu says, like the Dakota Access Pipeline and the South Dakota Keystone Pipeline leak, Keystone XL is an issue that crosses all racial boundaries.
This is a human being issue about what's good for our environment, what's good for our children.
The Crow Creek Tribal Chairman anticipates an even greater protest against Keystone XL than there was against the Dakota Access Pipeline. I'm Jim Kent.
Authorities are investigating a deadly weekend shooting at a Northern California tribe. Peggy Berryhill has more.
Early Sunday morning, a shooting occurred at a residence on the Point Arena Manchester Rancheria. An unknown assailant stood outside the residence and peppered it with bullets. Callers indicated that two females, a 32-year-old adult and a 15-year-old juvenile, had been struck by gunfire. The 32-year-old was pronounced dead at the scene, and the 15-year-old was taken to the hospital in Santa Rosa. She was later released. A vehicle was heard leaving the area in a rapid manner. The unknown assailant is still at large. The names of the victims have not been released yet. This is Peggy Berryhill reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler sent a directive to the city's other leaders today, instructing most city bureaus to propose budget cuts for the next fiscal year. There are concerns about a looming deficit due to pension payments, new labor agreements, and general inflation. The city has 27 main bureaus, all but three of which are being asked to propose cuts. The three that aren't get most of their funds from fees. That's the Water Bureau, Environmental Services, and Development Services. The rest get most of their money from the general fund. Wheeler also asked for similar cuts last year before he had taken office, though at that time he asked for only 2% cuts from public safety bureaus and from the Housing Bureau. In the meantime, according to the Portland Tribune, Wheeler has said the city spends more than it can afford for services for the homeless. He has, however, stated that reducing homelessness, if not funding homeless services, is a priority for the 2018 to 2019 fiscal year. Other stated priorities, according to the Oregonian, include increasing housing supply, maintaining infrastructure, increasing public safety, increasing police accountability, better preparing the city for a major earthquake, and adapting to new technologies.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report from our friends at Making Contact about First Nations language and art. At 6, it's Cutie Pop Talk. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, cloudy with showers likely, down to 54 for a low 60% chance of rain. Wednesday, those showers will continue, a high of 61. Today in history, on November 21st, 1877, Thomas Edison announced his invention of the phonograph to record and play back sound. The American inventor actually stumbled upon one of his great inventions while working on a way to record telephone communication at his lab in New Jersey. Edison acquired more than 1,000 patents throughout his lifetime. The quote of the day is from Edison, who said, "Many of life's failures are people who did not realize how close they were to success when they gave up."
And next we hear the fourth installment in our special series titled Sex for Sale, produced by volunteers here at the KBOO Evening News. It looks at where the Portland sex industry and the sex trafficking epidemic overlaps or doesn't.
This is the fifth in a series of 10 episodes in the KBOO Evening News series, Sex for Sale. This time, we're talking about the laws and regulations that affect the sex industry here in Portland. What are those laws, and are they working? Ever heard of the Nordic model? And could you be a trafficker? The FBI is at the center of investigations of trafficking and sex crimes that cross state lines. Here's Agent Bean talking about the Bureau's focus on minors, both male and female.
you do that minor recovery, you encounter the minor, and hopefully at the same time start building your investigation on the adults who trafficked her. You know, I say girls, and it generally is. And with sexual exploitation of children, all children have the capacity to be sexually exploited, certain. And we do have cases and investigations that have involved male victims, even minor male victims. It kind of looks a little different, though, when it involves a minor male. You don't see the minors being advertised as much on Backpage when they're men or boys. That tends to not be the venue for that, but there are venues for it, and it does occur. We try to focus on individuals who are either in the sex industry through fraud, force, and coercion, and of course we investigate cases where a minor has been exploited sexually.
The FBI grants something called Title 18 authority to the local police.
On our task force, we deputize our task force officers with Title 18 authority, so that enables them to go ahead and conduct federal investigations with us.
The U.S. Department of Justice has a violent crimes unit that investigates sex trafficking, a subject we'll be discussing in more detail in the next episode of this series. Here's U.S. Attorney Scott Kern.
So where the federal government's going to primarily get involved is in the investigation and prosecution of sex trafficking offenses. When we talk about sex trafficking, what we're talking about is the recruitment, harboring, transportation, providing, obtaining, patronizing, or soliciting a person for the purposes of a commercial sex act. And by commercial sex, that's simply any sex act on account of which anything of value is given to or received by any person. So primarily with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the federal government, things that are criminalized are the sex trafficking of minors, obviously anyone under the age of 18 years old, as well as sex trafficking that involves force, fraud, or coercion.
Keep in mind that if you travel overseas to engage in trafficking, you can face federal charges here in Portland when you get home.
Our office has prosecuted people for going overseas to engage in sexual activity with minors. Is if you travel in interstate or foreign commerce with the intent or purpose of engaging in criminal sexual activity, you can be prosecuted. Now, the issue is where you're going to be prosecuted. And if someone left from Portland and traveled overseas with that purpose, they could possibly be prosecuted here in the District of Oregon.
The Portland Police Bureau is dealing with local issues most often related to prostitution. They focus on eliminating demand. Here's Undercover Agent A.
Our team is focusing more and more on the buyer side, on the demand. They call it the demand.
Okay.
The idea there is that it's an economics issue. If there were no buyers, there would be no reason to traffic persons, right? So we are trying to focus on the demand and educate people on that so they don't buy sex. I can tell you that last year my team arrested 200 buyers. We're on track to do the same this year, but that's not counting the other compelling and promoting. And
given that most prostitution now is internet-based, we wondered how the police deal with that.
We've seen that the majority of our trafficking and prostitution activity is online. Most of the women are going online if they have access to the internet, and that's where they're soliciting. We had to learn about lots of different things we didn't know about previously. We had to learn about all the different websites, and then we had to try and find a way into them, which is not always easy. In some ways, it makes it easier because we can access a broader scope of the people being victimized than we could who are just walking up and down the street, and we're only going to see the ones we see. So in some ways it's better, in some ways it's harder.
Can the police respond to an ad and set up a meeting and then arrest someone?
Yes.
Yes. Do you do that?
Yes, we do.
So the Portland police follow what's called the Nordic model, going after customers. The Portland police have decided to relabel pimping as trafficking, even when the key elements of trafficking, exploitation of a child and use of force, are lacking. They don't like the word pimp because they feel, rightly so, that it suggests a lifestyle that's been glamorized in pop culture and should be rejected at every opportunity. Here's Undercover Agent A clarifying the language.
compelling prostitution, which is a Measure 11 crime, as he talked about, a felony.
Compelling.
Right.
That's like being a pimp.
Right. So it would be like being a pimp or a trafficker. We like to call them traffickers, just to not glorify the word pimp.
Is a pimp the same as a trafficker?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We try not to call them pimps because our society kind of glorifies the word pimp to mean something cool. Survivor advocates think
that's what agent, a trafficker, that's a different kind of crime, isn't it? Trafficking.
Trafficking is what we call someone who compels or profits from prostitution acts.
Okay.
Who is not the prostitute themselves.
It's not just someone who manages an underage person or a person against their will in sex. It's anyone whom you would have called a pimp before, a trafficker.
Yes.
Well, that's an important distinction, huh? I'm not sure our other people that I've talked with would use the same words in the same way.
So I guess if you think of it like this, so there are two different crimes. There's promoting prostitution, and then there's compelling prostitution. So promoting prostitution is aiding or facilitating an act of prostitution or receiving money or other profits from prostitution as a third party. Compelling prostitution is forcing someone, either against their will or through force, fraud, or coercion, to work as a prostitute, or any time you are promoting a juvenile.
That sounds enlightened. But wait, here's a different viewpoint from labor economist Dr. De La Justa. She contends that prosecuting Johns has essentially the same effect as going after prostitutes.
You may have heard Europe is massively moving towards this so-called Nordic model of prostitution regulation, which basically tries to criminalize clients. And the UK as well has moved towards criminalization of clients quite significantly over the years. And that means, therefore, that although prostitution may not be a crime in and of itself from the point of view of those who sell the services, it is from the point of view of those who purchase the service. In terms of what it does to the business, it actually creates the same problems, right? Whether you criminalize the person supplying or the person demanding, it pushes the business underground and makes it unsafe.
This may seem like semantics, but how we use the word trafficking is important. Here's Red Reed, an escort and activist, on this distinction.
The federal definition of trafficking is fairly explicit. It requires force, fraud, and coercion. But in operation in Portland, they tend to use the Canadian definition of trafficking, which is the Nordic model. Anyone who profits off of, you know, money earned through sex is a trafficker.
You know, I questioned them about that. And they define all pimps as traffickers.
Yeah.
Even though the federal regulation is that a trafficker is a person only who forces women or who takes young, underage women.
Yeah. The approach the Portland police take also means that we can't have safety calls because if we get in trouble, our safety call will be liable to be charged as our pimp. So there was a very famous, not locally famous case on my birthday, actually, a few years ago, where a woman was murdered. Her mom was her safety call. Her mom called the hotel multiple times. The hotel didn't do anything. And eventually her body was found in the stairwell of the hotel. But the mom didn't call the police because she knew that she would be charged as a trafficker of her daughter.
Couldn't the PPB use another word for pimp instead of trafficker? A word that didn't mislead and confuse the public? How about procurer? How about hustler, panderer, whoremonger? Anything but trafficker.
Red also criticizes the police bureau on what could be called profiling. We're familiar with racial and ethnic profiling, but sex worker profiling, that's something we hadn't thought of. Are lower-income folks and people of color affected more adversely or just differently than other sectors in this industry?
Both, more adversely and differently. You can tell by the people that the DA charges, you know, or targets, hair weaves, the fake nails, that they're going after things that are stereotypically markers of women of color, you know, things that are fashionable, although they've moved into the white mainstream, but you know, on women of color, those things signify something to white cops that they don't signify in our communities.
A certain look can get you attention you don't want. And we'd like your feedback. At the end of this series, we'll do a full episode in which you get to speak your mind on this subject. If you have a comment or question about the series or about the sex trade, we'd like to hear it. Call the KBOO newsroom at 503-231-8032, and we'll hear you out and put you on the air.
One of the worst crimes in the industry, and the one that seems to get the most attention, is that of trafficking. We talked about it here briefly, but it has a broader impact.
Is it the most important crime in the industry? Is trafficking a form of slavery? We'll take on those issues in our next episode. This is Tom.
And this is Natalie. That's it for episode 5.
CBS has fired its morning anchor, Charlie Ruse, and PBS has cut his long-running interview show. The action today came after a report in the Washington Post that detailed years of sexual misconduct against dozens of women. Noor O'Donnell, one of Rose's co-anchors on CBS This Morning, said on the show that there is no excuse for this alleged behavior. She said this is a, quote, moment that demands a frank and honest assessment about where we stand and more generally the safety of women. Rose did not deny the accusations against him and issued an apology. He's been a presence on American television for 45 years.
A federal judge says the Trump administration cannot stop paying for sex reassignment surgery for military members. This marks the second time a federal judge has stopped the Trump administration's proposed transgender military ban. The decision from U.S. District Judge Marvin Garbus comes just weeks after another judge in Washington blocked Trump's plan to stop military recruitment of transgender men and women. According to the Washington Post, it could have forced the firings of military members as soon as March. Today's preliminary injunction from the judge in Baltimore goes a step further, preventing the government from denying funding for sex reassignment surgeries. In the 53-page order, Judge Garbus says that transgender service members have, quote, demonstrated that they've already suffered harmful consequences, such as the cancellation and postponements of surgeries, the stigma of being set apart as inherently unfit, facing the prospect of discharge and inability to commission as an officer, the inability to move forward with long-term medical plans, and the threat to their prospects of obtaining long-term assignments, end of quote. You may remember, back in July, President Trump surprised members of the military and Congress when he announced the proposal by tweets. Six active-duty service members in Maryland filed the challenge days after Trump issued an order reversing the Obama-era policy allowing transgender men and women to serve openly and to get funding for sex reassignment surgery. In today's preliminary injunction, the judge found the challengers were likely to succeed in their claim that the president's order violates the Constitution's equal protection guarantees and the rights of service members to medical care. Garbus was nominated to the bench by former President George H.W. Bush.
And now we hear from our friends at Climate Connections. This is a daily podcast that informs the public on how global warming is affecting our daily lives and aimed to provide constructive solutions. Today's report explains why some homes are now cooled with ice in a modern twist on an old-fashioned method.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During the summer, people flock to the scenic island of Nantucket. Electricity use spikes, largely because of energy-guzzling air conditioners. It's become more than the island's two transmission lines can handle. Building a third line from mainland Massachusetts would cost at least $75 million, so officials are pursuing other options.
They were interested in solutions that would do something about this increased demand.
Mike Hopkins runs Ice Energy. The company makes an alternative to standard AC called an Ice Bear. The system freezes a tank of water. Then air is pushed across the ice and vented into the home. The system slightly reduces a home's overall power use, but its main benefit is that the energy-intensive work, making ice, happens at night, when demand on the power grid is low. Then, during peak daytime hours,
cooling with the melting ice uses less than 5% of what the air conditioner would have required in terms of electricity.
The state announced it will provide more than 200 Nantucket homes with Ice Bears. The goal of this pilot project is to help Nantucket solve its energy problems without the expense of a new transmission line. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Uber has announced that hackers were able to get the personal information of 57 million Uber users around the world, including names, email addresses, and mobile phone numbers. This includes at least 600,000 Uber customers in the U.S. Uber's CEO says the company is working to be as, quote, honest and transparent as we work to repair our past mistakes. The problem traces to late 2016, when Uber first became aware that two people outside the company had inappropriately accessed user data stored on a third-party cloud-based service. The company says forensics experts have not seen any indication that trip location history, credit card numbers, bank account numbers, social security numbers, or dates of birth were downloaded. Uber says it is contacting drivers whose driver's license numbers were downloaded and offering them free credit monitoring and ID theft protection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Tom Flynn, and Annette Newell. The producer is Zelos Marchant. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seaway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Annette Newell. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 9 on Alternative Radio, author Michael Parenti looks at the newly released archives on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D-May Roberts presents a special documentary on Jim Pepper, the Portland jazz musician who's celebrated each year during the Native Arts Festival. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate and become a member.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, and we'd like to remind you that this program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's Coffee Shop is open every day at East Burnside and 8th Avenue.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For this special in-depth segment, our friends at Making Contact from Radio Project in Oakland, California, brings us this story. It follows Vincent Medina's and Isabella Zizi's deep and personal experiences on Native American organizing and activism in the Bay Area. If you enjoy what you hear, you can also listen to the full segment at 5 p.m. this Thursday.
I'm RJ Lozada, and this is Making Contact. On today's episode, we bring you a special broadcast and present you two Making Contact storytelling fellows, Vincent Medina and Isabella Zizi. They're building upon the traditions and the work of their elders for themselves and the next generations. The Ohlone are the first peoples of the Bay Area, covering areas from the coastline along San Francisco to as far inland as Salinas Valley. After near eradication, the Ohlone were all but completely eliminated and enveloped within the colonizers' world, their languages and cultures criminalized and swallowed up. It would be several generations before the Ohlone would be able to regenerate and reclaim fractions of land rightfully theirs. Making Contact Community Storytelling Fellow Vincent Medina is part of the current generation of Ohlone that are deeply invested in language and cultural revitalization. Whether paying homage to Coyote Hills Park in Fremont or teaching Chochenyo language courses at Mission San Jose, Vincent finds firm footing in his deep running roots.
Uyakish rote mak warep tak rote payan hitkanakshe. Aye payan hitkanakshe amashmite ya payan muekma aloni. Imhen truhi toekshek ma watin makruaitka aye kikne mak wetrish payan hitkanakshe ya watin. Makwetrish kikne mayan.
Our language almost vanished from the earth. In 1921, in the midst of this tragedy, an elderly woman living in the deep brown canyons of Sinol, named Angela de los Colos, proclaimed with defiance, Kana akwe tak yuwa tak nanwente. As for me, I am not going to stop speaking. She, along with the also aging Jose Guzman, worked frantically to record, speak, and protect Chochenyo, the language spoken in the East Bay since time immemorial, which was on the brink of death, the precipice of never being used again. What a world that must have been. I can only imagine, but my heart begins to ache at the thought. These people, my elders, my heroes, they made a conscious decision to keep speaking Chochenyo, and to fight against time as though in the defiance of gravity. They knew they were the only ones who could protect our language, and they lunged, ducked, and leapt over the hurdles of reality in order to keep the flicker of light from moving into ashes and darkness. Angela and Jose, they weren't going out without a fight. Yellow parchment papers became full of frantic scribbles, an outpour of heartbreak, family histories, gossip, lore, loss and victories, and stories that stretch back to the very beginning of time, described with such an intimacy and an immediacy that they seem to have happened yesterday. Tales of a time when giants roamed the East Bay, when Coyote left his footprints embedded in the earth, when hills and spirits had emotions and proper names, when bodies of stone were defeated in the underworlds, and when songs were sung just about Mount Diablo and Mission Peak. Don't forget this, I picture them telling us. Don't give up on this. Now, right now, let's read these words together, okay? Just so we can get the pronunciation. So for day, truhi.
Truhi.
Now try again. Truhi.
Truhi.
Try it with your tongue a little bit further back in your throat. Truhi.
Truhi.
He'e. Orshe. Rakat.
Rakat.
Say it a little bit longer. Rakat.
Rakat. My name is Gabriel Medina and I'm 13 years old. I've been learning around 2 years. It's like a secret language. I was in fourth grade and we were doing the mission project and we were learning about Native American Indians, and I told my teacher that I was Native American, and she said that I wasn't because I didn't look Native American, and she knows what a Native American looks like. It's her opinion. I know that I am, though.
I realized just the sounds of the language were something incredible on its own. Being able to connect those old sounds to places here in the East Bay, you could hear the land in the language itself. You know, wherever you're at here in this place, you can often just see like those drops and rises and falls that make the Bay Area what it is, and that's so embedded within our language. It helped me connect in a way to my ancestors that just the words strictly on their own might not. There's context that's there. It tells people who are related. It tells the conditions that people had to go through. It tells the experiences that people had and how people consistently survived and adapted to the changes around them and kept intact what they could in order to keep their culture strong and alive. And when I would read that and connect that with the words, connect that with living in my land, and the fact that Gabriel and myself, you know, two brothers, we both were born in our traditional village, We're meant to be in our homeland. We're meant to be speaking this language. Our elders, they're our guiding forces in many ways. They are a link to the old world that our ancestors lived in. When you go to the language, because I know that you've been to one of the language classes that we had here, when you use some of the Chochenyo words, how does it make you feel when you use them?
Oh, I feel that I'm not saying them properly.
You know what? Surprisingly, and I talked about this with one of the professors that I have at UC Berkeley that I work with. And out of everybody, when we were having that class that first time, you got the pronunciation the closest to the way that I hear the old people say it in the recordings.
Oh, really?
And it was because I think that you probably heard stuff growing up. So somewhere back there in your mind, it's still there. But when you would get the sounds, there's a sounds that I can't get when I pronounce things that you... Well, Aunt Dottie, in many ways, she's like the matriarch of our family.
It must be because you heard it growing up.
Probably so. You know, some words stick and some words don't. And some words you can't get them out.
Yeah, that's
true. You know, as hard as you try.
She's a tough lady. She's a strong lady. And she's always been somebody who's carried culture forward for us. She's always, and throughout her life, found ways to protect our identity. And she's always found ways to make sure that those who are around are proud to be Ohlone. In the 1960s, Aunt Dottie was the one who led our cemetery being saved near Mission San Jose.
Well, the only person that I ever heard speak the language would be Uncle Dottie. Mm-hmm. And there were some other family members that came from Livermore that also spoke the language. But to say that I ever remembered what they said, you know, I couldn't repeat it because I don't know the language.
She listened to the old-timers who lived on the old Sinol Rancheria and listened to them speak the language, listened to them tell the old stories that stretch back to the very beginning.
Proud of yourself that has you've taken this upon yourself to be able to teach the younger people the language. Which is something that we never had, you know, only bits and pieces now and then, but nothing that ever stuck to us because we were too busy with other thoughts.
Yeah, I understand.
You know,
Kathy, she's a really unique person because she's able to know a whole lot about the old ways, and Kathy also has a lot of insight about my great grandmother, Mary Archuleta, who, for a brief time while she was in college, she lived with her in the 1970s. When I spoke with Kathy, Kathy was telling me that she could remember hearing our language spoken all the way into the 1950s. She could remember her mother, Maggie Peanuts, and my great-grandmother standing around, and she could hear the language. I just remember thinking to myself, how much pride and how excited I felt to know that my great-grandmother, somebody who held me in her arms, that she might have been a speaker of our language in her younger years.
There we go. Okay, so basically I just wanted to ask you a few questions just about Nana, and especially what she was like in your younger years when you were when you lived with her. One thing I always wondered about, especially with Nana, because I know that she spent time in the orphanage at the mission, and I know that her mom, Victoria Marine, passed away when she was very young over in Sinol. And the stories that I hear from my grandma about this was that things got really hard when she entered the orphanage, where she was separated from her sister, Flora. And there was obviously some really rough things that happened. But I wondered, especially because when I was a kid, Nana was always so proud to be Indian. She was always so proud about who she was, and she would always tell us, you know, that we're Ohlone. And I wonder how she was able to carry on all of that pride in her culture, even with the things that she had to go through that were painful. And
she was a lot like my grandmother, Aralinda. The both of them were in Maggie Juarez and Pete Juarez's house. They were living with them. Okay. Evidently, they must have, my great-great aunt, I guess she would be my great-great aunt, Maggie Peanuts. I get what they called her Peanuts, but it was Maggie Juarez. She's the one that took them, I believe, out of the orphanage. And I guess because your Nana was chosen and not the rest of them, that may have caused, you know, the conflict or the bad feelings, you know. But they used to get called to for the meat, the buffalo meat, okay. And when every year when they would get called, she would make the calls to everybody, and we were one of the families. We'd all get together and we'd go to Ohlone Park, and we would all celebrate. We'd all be dancing. Mike loved to dance. Your Nana made all of his regalia, all of his clothing. Okay. My sister Margaret is your Nana's godmother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
So that's how close we were, you know. And your Nana would make things and give it to my sister because that was her godchild.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Did, with Nana, so you could remember that there was times so that the Aralinda and Maggie Peanuts, they would speak the language, right?
Yeah. Can you kind of keep them guys quiet?
There were birds that were very loud in the background. And I remember when I would go to see my great-grandmother as a child, there would be birds that would always be everywhere in her house. And the same birds were in Kathy's as well. Oh, glorious fighters, stubborn ancestors, people of defiance, people of wisdom, gravity breakers. Today, as a result of your refusal to surrender our language, we can speak the words yet again. Because of those scribbles on parchment paper, our land hears Chochenyo a second time. It's been inside of us all along. The words, they caress us like a loving grandmother's embrace. They comfort us like an old familiar song, and they bring us dignity by connecting us to our ancestors. They connect us to the East Bay, Makruaitka, our home, Makperetka, our land, the place that we love, the place that those before us fought so hard to stay in, the place that we originate from. My elders, my heroes, you saved our language from ever being forgotten, and we will not relinquish Chochenyo, for it thrives in the footsteps of giants. Urshatruhi hemmenya kanakra kat vince medina ayanesem tahi making contact. Thank you.
And that was a brief digression of Oscar Peterson playing some Duke Ellington tunes in a sentimental mood and don't get around much anymore. And you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is Cutie Pop Talk.
Unhappy about the current political regime? Want to do something about it? Something social justice related? And how do you find out about these things? Portland Resistance Calendar lets you know about a lot of these happening in the Portland area for the next week. It's a weekly podcast. It's a blog. It's a calendar. It's a floor cleaner. It's updated on Fridays. Learn more at kboo.fm/resist.